Welcome to the first edition of the Slow Burn podcast. This is your source for explorations into emerging trends around crypto that we think matter. I'm Clay, here with the Slow Crypto team, Sam and Caroline, and our first guest on the show, Mike Saul of Goldfinch. Welcome, Mike. Anyone that's been reading our newsletter knows a bunch of fun and experimentation we've been doing internally, as well as digging into different legal structures, has led us down the rabbit hole of real-world assets. And I think for those that are new, RWAs is the umbrella term for the efforts of a small but enthusiastic set of builders who are doing the hard work to bring everything from real estate to soybean derivatives into an on-chain environment, which we really think will have a ton of positive benefits to assets in terms of accessibility, liquidity, transaction costs, and transparency. And so with that as a background, we're really excited to have Mike, one of the leaders in the ecosystem, on the show, as he and the rest of the Goldfinch team have been building on the leading edge of this theme for almost 3 years now. To get things started, Mike, can you give us a basic primer on you and Goldfinch and how you see your role in the RWA ecosystem?
Cool. Yeah. And thanks for having me. This is great. Background on me is I'm one of the co-founders of Goldfinch and the CEO of Warboro Labs, which is our developer team that's working on the Goldfinch protocol. Before this, I've been working at tech startups here in the Bay Area for a while now. And just before Goldfinch was at Coinbase for a couple of years, running the product analytics team there. And so my background is all on the tech side and have been interested in crypto for a while now. And background about Goldfinch, like what we're doing with Goldfinch, is building a credit protocol. It's all about getting capital out into the world to previously underserved borrowers. And the real focus of the protocol right now is on lending businesses in markets around the world, a combination of fintech businesses and lending businesses that have on-the-ground operations where they lend out to small businesses or consumers in their local markets. They have a real expertise in their local markets, as well as credit funds that kind of act as channel partners that get capital to those kinds of businesses. And Goldfinch, as a protocol, is a warehouse lender where we're getting capital into the hands of these lending businesses to help them grow their operations. So that's really what we're doing at Goldfinch, is creating this marketplace to get this source of capital that is looking for great yields into the hands of these businesses that have been traditionally underserved. And just last week, we crossed 2 million of like end borrowers, both consumers and businesses, now in over 20 countries. And I think it's a great example, as you described, of the RWA space, which I view RWA as like what got me started with Goldfinch originally, is seeing that a lot of what happens in crypto today is self-referential. Like, how do we get capital into the actual real broader economy and get that into the space? And how do we bridge that gap? That's what Goldfinch is trying to do, is make that happen.
Yeah, it was interesting growing up in the DeFi ecosystem as it was emerging in 2018, 2019. That self-referential element was the necessary starting point to get all the infrastructure built to enable what you're building today. And so as you looked at DeFi and sitting in your seat at Coinbase in 2020, what were sort of the things that started to click that said, hey, the infrastructure is actually ready for this to exist?
So we started in 2020. We were at Coinbase for a couple of years before then, and seeing all these core infrastructural pieces in place and just feeling like antsy, like we could really make more happen. And the big pieces were like, one was stablecoins, because folks outside of crypto are not going to be, or at least yet, like transacting in Bitcoin or Ethereum. Like, they do their business in their local currencies or often around the world in US dollar based denominations. And so having USDC and other stablecoins was just critical for doing anything outside of the crypto space. And even in like 2018, there was little amount of like just total stablecoin, but getting into 2020, it had grown a lot. And then a second big piece of the infrastructure that was necessary was the off-ramps in these countries all around the world. So I remember in 2019, 2020, both Coinbase and Binance were starting to open up new off-ramps in Africa and Southeast Asia and like other places around the world. And it's really hard to do things with these kinds of countries when they have no way to like turn the actual stablecoin they receive into like deposit into their local banks. And so those were two big infrastructural pieces. And then there was a third mindset piece, which was this like growing user base in the crypto space looking for yields. And so places like Compound were just amazing and super critical of creating the set level expectation of like kicking off yield farming and this idea of like, where do you find regular yields? And then I just pointed to this demand in the space that made all the pieces fit together.
That makes sense. Every conversation we've had with people that are building the space, and then like our lived experience, which Caroline and Sam can attest to, is that structure and the legal overhead are the toughest pieces of building with RWAs. And so I guess as you were looking at Goldfinch, what were the necessary loopholes that you had to go through, or things within the US or outside of the US that you had to build around to actually make the end-to-end infrastructure go?
So I wouldn't say we were using any loopholes. I was wondering if you were going to fall for that. I was like, wow, Clay, way to tee it up.
It was a mental trap.
I have spent too many hours with lawyers from the very beginning to think about it in terms of loopholes. I feel like the very beginning of Goldfinch was just thinking about the legal side of things and all of this stuff. And I remember early on figuring, okay, so like to do this stuff, you need to do like KYC, know your customer, which is getting a lot of information about the specific people who are interacting with the protocol. And coming from the crypto space, anonymity is important to a lot of people. And if we have to do know your customer, is that just like this blocker until like being able to do this? But enough hours with the lawyers were helping us understand that there's no way around that from the broader economy perspective. And it's important to us as like a developer team building this, but we're talking to our customers. And the customers that we're working with, they're like lending businesses. They are highly regulated businesses in their markets in all of these countries around the world. They have licenses to do lending. They cannot take any money from anything that might be like a terrorist, for example. Like it's just like a complete non-starter for them. And so to get them to use crypto, they need things like know your customer. And so we just realized, okay, if we actually believe crypto can have this impact in the world, and we believe that it can be used in this economy outside of the self-referential crypto space, we need to have know your customer system of some form to get these companies okay with using protocols in the space. So we built a know your customer NFT, which we call UID, which is like everyone who uses the protocol needs to get this non-transferable NFT that shows that they went through KYC. And now it's just this like critical piece to get these companies all around the world to be willing to even use the protocol as customers to even receive capital from it. And so it's not a loophole, but that's a core infrastructural piece that we had to put together to even like get past the initial starting point of these companies being willing to use it.
I'm old enough to think about crypto and like the parallels to early internet. And what was interesting if you think about it is like early internet, we basically had this world where there's this new superpower gets unleashed. It really sees no borders, it can be global, blah, blah, blah. And there's 1,000 local different regulations around speech. For long enough, no one paid attention. You ended up with basically an American internet for 20 years as a reasonably stable configuration. Now we're seeing that devolve where you have like regional internets, regional rules, lots of legal and complexity around compliance, et cetera. Crypto is fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice type thing. Where globally, you have an incredibly complicated tapestries of laws that you have to comply with. And it's really interesting to me because I think one of the things that's been thinking about the history here is the nice part about quote-unquote self-referential crypto is that it's able to basically ignore all the complexities of the real world in theory and just sit in its own little island and say, okay, the way this is going to grow is like in other land, right? Whereas people like you in the real world stuff, you're like, okay, if I want to connect this back to the real world, all of a sudden I do have this incredible overhead of different things. And I think that's actually part of the reason it has been so little innovation in it is because most people that are interested in the techno-utopian views of crypto are very uninterested in dealing with regulatory real world shit to move shit around. And so I guess for me is I want to ask two questions about this. Like one is, what was the background that where you were like, okay, we're going to take that on effectively versus like, what is the DNA that kind of got you to that place where you're like, okay, we're willing to be the bridge people,
right? Yeah,
to the utopian people. How many of there are you? The second is like, when you think about the tapestry problem, right? I'm sure you're violating a bunch of laws in a bunch of countries, but like, how do you think about navigating a world where you're not going to get Internet 2.0, right? If that makes sense, early Internet 2.0, where you can kind of just have one framework globally, but instead need to be more nuanced about it.
So I would not say that we're violating a bunch of laws in any countries.
There must be some country.
A big part of what we're doing is taking a view of like, it's not our understanding that we're violating any laws anyway. A big part of that too is crypto is generally unregulated in a lot of places. And so sometimes what we're doing is trying to think of where do we think the spirit of the law is going to be heading and where do we think regulators are going to go and build for that, both because it's a more long-term play to do it that way, but then also we're not here to just violate the law. We're here to expand access to capital and do all that good stuff. And I think of, but when I think about the law thing too, so something that also comes up when we're thinking about an unregulated space is like the key part is just to not cause harm to people. That's usually where the laws come up. And so if we build it in a way where like we're doing things that show where the collateral is coming from and we're giving people the information that they need and we prevent these black boxes that have actually caused harm to other people, and we're able to help people actually make sound source of yield, then we're also still heading in a direction that's good, even if some of the space is unregulated. So I got to say that a few times. But then I think your other question of why we were willing to do this building the bridge and get into this stuff where it's pretty hard. I feel like coming from the sort of tech side, it's really compelling to like build a smart contract and then just put it out in the world and have it immediately be used a lot. It's like a dopamine hit. But when we started, my co-founder Blake and I, we talked at the very beginning of what we want to do is do something that's like particularly hard. The fact that this was a hard thing to do was part of the draw to us to do it, because something that is easy, it means that a lot of people are going to do it and the opportunity there is smaller. But if we like work on something that's really hard to do, there's going to be fewer people who are willing to do it and the opportunity is bigger. And then we were looking at where can crypto have the real impact. And it's nice, this sort of self-referential aspect of crypto, but like the broader global economy, you add like many zeros to the opportunity there. And so we're like, okay, we got to do that. And the fact that there's like all these complications that happen on the legal side was almost like a benefit.
That makes a lot of sense. We obviously fundamentally agree that the opportunity is much bigger, bridging versus creating like a world 2.0 that's fully digital. Where do you think we are on the spectrum of not just you, but other people being like, fuck it, we'll do the bridges and we'll take a bunch of this stuff on, a bunch of the complexity? Because like, the reality is like the smart contract thing is a fun game, but ultimately, especially it's all open source, there's no real value in it.
I remember when we were starting Goldfinch, and this was in the summer of 2020, that was when SushiSwap was like doing the vampire attack.
Yeah.
On Uniswap. And then a lot of the conversations there, and like when we were talking to investors, were like, oh, like, how do you actually build a moat here and have a long-term advantage if like any other protocol can basically just copy prior protocols? And then SushiSwap was happening as like an example of like, oh, we thought Uniswap had a lot of network effects, but then already it was starting to be like copied. So yeah.
It's interesting to hear just you talking about the decision point around throwing up the KYC information, because when I was sitting at Xerox Labs in 2018 or 2019, we had this concept of permission liquidity pools, and the infrastructure itself is actually not that difficult to build, but to have that sort of coincidence of wants meet and have both sides want to be permissioned so that you have that trusted environment. Do you think that element of trust and matching of liquidity that wants those known counterparties together actually creates somewhat of a moat in that you would have to go to an unpermissioned environment to access a different form of it, and therefore going through something like Goldfinch is the right and trusted source for access to this type of credit?
The sheer fact of a match being made, I don't know if that creates a moat. And that's because, especially on the capital side, at least what I've observed is like folks with capital are very happy to move quickly to whatever the next thing is or the next place is to optimize their yields. And so if the main benefit there is that you've reduced some like costs or frictions in terms of matching the capital to the entity that's like seeking capital, then if there's another place that has even lower frictions or lower costs, it's likely to like move faster. The moat can come from two places. One, like what we're creating here is a marketplace. And then the network effects of the marketplace is if it's the place that all the folks seeking capital are going to and all the folks providing capital are going to, then the next person who is seeking capital is going to go to that marketplace because all of the like infrastructural pieces are in place that make it easier. And then the capital will also do that. The second part of the moat is that by bridging to the real world and getting these borrowers to come onto Goldfinch from all of these places around the world, they're like paying into the Goldfinch smart contract. And if you wanted to do like a vampire attack of Goldfinch, for example, you have to convince all of these businesses in 20 plus countries around the world to start paying into a different set of smart contracts. It's like a much bigger hurdle to do. And so there's that element of it too. So I'd say those are where I see like the moats being built. But the sheer fact of making the match between someone providing capital and someone seeking capital, the reason why they're doing that just in that siloed kind of case is some reduced friction there. And if you have even more reduced friction, it would move. I think you need like marketplace kind of network effects and just integrations that all these businesses are building mm-hmm. into a particular smart contract that makes it hard to convince all of them switch over to
the trust.
I think trust too. Yeah, for sure.
Establishes routes. I trust this counterparty. I trust this marketplace.
The yeah. counterparty can go somewhere else and bring their trust with them in theory. I mean, that's the hope of crypto.
Yeah,
it's what makes it different than Prosper.com.
To that end, what have been the technical limitations around trustlessly bringing real-world assets on chain?
One of the technical limitations was making sure we had the off-ramps to work with. So I remember like early on, we were talking to this one company that was in Mali. they were like renting out motorcycles to folks in Mali to use them for doing Uber rides. And we were trying to figure out a way for them to get the capital. And we couldn't figure it out. There were no exchanges that supported Mali. And there was no way to like for them to get USDC and convert it into like the local jurisdiction. And they were even saying, oh, like we like purchased the motorcycles from France. So could we like send the USDC directly to the manufacturer in France? And we were like really trying to get creative to make it work, but it was really complex to do. That was like a big kind of technical constraint. It's just like that off-ramp component to help them get it into their local fiat.
We talked a little bit also about the Oracle problem and some of the slow burn articles that have come out. So we know that you have this sort of auditor system that is pioneering one type of Oracle. Would you mind talking a little bit about that and how that could maybe help some of the trust issues with instantiating real-world assets on-chain?
The auditor system is a part of the protocol that's in our white paper. It isn't built yet, but it will be coming soon. And that is around creating a set of folks who are preventing kind of collusion in the protocol. And by collusion, the way the protocol works is they're the folks who invest directly into the borrowers. We call them the backers. And they are effectively doing this evaluation of the borrowers to decide if the borrower is creditworthy. And that's like the primary way that is determined if the borrowers are good. But the big potential problem, like where this could go awry, is if those investors are colluding with the borrower and this not actually a good borrower, but they're just like colluding with each other to get that borrower capital. How do you prevent that collusion? That's where the auditors come in. And the role of the auditors is they are randomly selected and they are there to evaluate, is this a real borrower who is talking to real backers or are they just pretending to do it? And the auditors are like this like second check to prevent the collusion from happening. I guess it's a form of an oracle of this like real world human check on the borrowers that they are who they say they are. I would also say another kind of version of an oracle that we're using with Goldfinch is what I described before of KYC, NMT, that we call UID. The form of an oracle that's bringing this like off-chain information saying, I guess this person is a real person. They have done a KYC check and they're like not a sanctioned individual or company. It's just like another form of an oracle.
So if I'm understanding both sides correctly, the auditor check mitigates the risk of fraud and then the UID mitigates the risk of something like a Sybil attack?
Yes, the auditors are reducing fraud. And then the UID is doing a couple of things. One is preventing Sybil attacks because part of the protocol, it assumes that there are like multiple people who are using it. In addition to that, the UID is ensuring for the borrowers, they're taking money from known customers. If they know their customers, they're not taking money from like sanctioned folks.
And who are the auditors? The way I think about it is you probably need some type of subject matter expertise, or is it on the spectrum of a mechanical Turk? I can just go and do these very cursory tasks. How specialized will auditors need to be?
The way I think about it is that they don't have to be very specialized. It's really the backers who are more specialized because they're the ones who are actually investing their own capital into the borrower and they need to evaluate this borrower. Are they good or not? Do they want to put their money into it? The auditor is not evaluating the creditworthiness of the borrower. The auditor is just evaluating, is this borrower who they say they are? You could look at the conversation between backers and borrowers and be like, is this like a fake made up conversation or is it real? Does the borrower have a website? We could give them documents that show their sort of like registration in whatever country they are in. The auditors can check, do they have a real document here? And so that in theory shouldn't require much expertise, if any, because they're not assessing creditworthiness. They're just assessing like whether someone's faking it or not.
GPT-3 will make it more fun.
Maybe we could turn GPT-3 into an oracle that just says the auditing.
Is the auditor system that you're creating, is it something that can be more of a generalized standard that other protocols that are looking to port types of assets from an off-chain environment on-chain could leverage as it's open source? Or is it kind of specialized to the types of assets and the type of fraud that you're looking to mitigate?
We haven't built it yet. I guess we'll see when we build it how generalizable it will be. I know from like product principles, we'll probably build it very specifically to meet Goldfinch's needs. And then if it turns out to be helpful for other protocols, maybe there's a way to generalize it. My hunch would be it'll be pretty specific to Goldfinch, but it's the generalizable concept of auditors being randomly selected to make a decision on something.
The auditor check really, it is a very specific question, which is there collusion? It's not, right?
That's right. Basically the check you're running. Are you basically KYC'd? And
yep.
And are you colluding?
Yeah.
Those are like the two bits you care about. Everything else is up to the market.
That's true. And actually, to take that further, then maybe you could make it generalizable where you just pose a certain question to a group of auditors. That's just like a general system that if it works really well on Goldfinch, it can work well on other protocols, which is, oh, you need human beings to do a human level check and you pose a question to them.
Yeah.
And you randomize it so that it's hard to like game the system.
How do you explain all of this to institutional investors and capital allocators into the borrow pools? What are those conversations like?
The questions that the institutions are asking a lot about are mostly about the credit risk and the yields. And they want to see these detailed data rooms about the borrowers. And they don't ask as many questions about the technology itself. They want to understand broadly how the Goldfinch protocol is working and how the different components of it work. But from their perspective, they're making investments directly into these opportunities with different borrowers. They want to understand, what is this investment opportunity? What are the yields? What's driving it? How is it collateralized? What are all the legal aspects of it? Those kinds of things.
So to that end, I mean, like, do they even care about crypto?
If anything, crypto for them right now is adding a little bit of friction. I think the one part of it for them that's interesting is the way there is liquidity mining. And so everyone who participates in the protocol gets to be a co-owner, allowing the users to be owners. And so they do find that token aspect interesting as well.
If you had to get to the real heart of it, forget the, you know, liquidity mining, which is cool, to be really clear, setting it off to the side. Like, I get it. I'm a capitalist. I'm an institution. Very simple. It's like, how much money can they make and what's my risk in trying to make that money? Full stop. I don't give a shit how you do it. And then the question for you is, like, there has to be leverage in it somewhere. What is the fundamental leverage?
The fundamental leverage comes from, one, accessibility, people being able to participate, and two, liquidity, it being easier to execute positions to other folks. And to get to the heart of it, like where I see crypto really changing things, I think of a comparison to what the cloud did for documents. Before the internet, before the cloud, you had a document that was on your computer, yeah, and you might make edits to it. And if you like want to give that document to somebody else, you have to like put on a CD and give it to somebody else. And then they can make edits on that document. And if you want those changes, they make the changes and they put on a CD and they like hand you back that like literal CD to you and you put in your computer. And then the cloud brought the documents out of this local silo into this global accessible place where now when any changes are happening on a document, everyone can access it. And crypto is doing the same thing with a cash flow, where today cash flows go through a bank account. And if you want to like give those cash flows to somebody else, what do you have to do? Like, you have to convince the person making those payments to pay in some other bank account, or you have to sign legal documents to like transfer ownership of that bank account to somebody else. And it's like the bank account is almost like this local silo. But when you have the cash flows going through a token in crypto, then it becomes this like globally accessible place, just like a document in the cloud, where anyone who is buying and selling it, if there's any changes in the cash flows or when that cash flow happens, everyone who owns the token is now getting a part of that. And then because of that, because you have removed all this need for coordination around who's owning and moving around the token, that's where you get this like crazy amount of accessibility and liquidity, because you can build markets around it and you can open it up across countries all around the world. And so I think of that kind of analogy of what, at its core, crypto is really changing.
Tell me if you think this is right or wrong, which is the really fundamental benefit is liquidity. It basically is saying, look, there's nothing you can do with real-world assets in crypto space, or really with crypto in general, that you can't do if you have enough scale and size to do it. If you have a $10 billion company, right, and it's something you want to like borrow against, the relative cost of the friction versus what you're doing is such that the friction doesn't really matter. Sure, you like pay some bankers too much money, but no one really cares. Whereas really what crypto does, like the fundamental point, is it basically drops the friction of doing a bunch of those high-end functions so low that there's a whole universe of assets and pools and parts of capitalism that are currently effectively offline. They're in local computers that all of a sudden can go online. And like, that is the point.
That sounds right, because like I always use two words. I use liquidity and accessibility, but you could view accessibility as a function of it, right? Because you have all these smaller companies that could be looking for liquidity that can't access the current financial systems. And so you could say, yeah, that like their ability to access capital on what they have, which are great businesses, is part of them getting liquidity.
There's this whole trend which exists right now. This is non-crypto world. Which is where they say, hey, we're going to take technology and we're going to go roll up a bunch of really small businesses into something bigger.
Yep.
And use technology to manage them better. But really, there's a financial hack to it, which is you're like, okay, these businesses are small. They're too small to access most of the global financial market. If we roll them all together, they become big enough and we could do this with technology that all of a sudden we get all these extra benefits. The crypto answer is, well, you don't have to roll them all together. If you just build, make the friction low enough for capitalism and do a bunch of stuff, which again, historically the market has had no interest in doing. Yes, I can make 12 cents on this transaction, but it's too small for me to bother with. But if you have
protocols that are open or protocols that bring that stuff online, that is the real world asset.
When we were starting Goldfinch, we were talking to all these businesses in these different markets, and what they were telling us was that they needed to raise $1 million or a couple million dollars. And in their local markets, they could get like 100K, like 200K from the local capital markets. But otherwise, the local banks there were just putting into high yield government bonds in their local markets. But then to get some of these institutional multinational folks like Goldman Sachs, like they could maybe go down to 30 million, 35 million, like minimum kind of investment in like company in Brazil. But like really, they're looking for like $50+ million. And the idea of them doing kind of like $1 million, $2 million deal isn't going to be interesting to them. So there's just like this whole big gap in the middle of these like really great companies that their local capital markets just aren't serving. But the current multinational kinds of banks, they need bigger, they need more scale.
It went to this school for two reasons. One is like anything, as once you're big enough, if it's not $1 billion opportunity, it's not worth the time mentally.
The other reason I think was like, look, all of these big institutions were set up with a presumption around acceptable friction. And so all of a sudden they literally structurally cannot serve these people because the cost of closing that deal is $1 million. The math was never work.
Seed funds, same thing. A lot of shenanigans recently, right? But like part of the historical thing was that you had a bunch of venture funds like, I can't write a check that small.
My model doesn't support it. And even if it did, I can only be on 5 deals this year. And so it's just not big enough.
And so the protocol for capitalism, right, I think is what you're talking about. It's like, how do you make these things small enough?
I guess the question for me comes back to like, do you exist and are you legal to transact with?
That's the KYC check, is like an obvious thing you need to bake into that protocol.
The are you colluding bit is like another like super obvious thing that you need, that needs to exist in order to do efficient, super small transactions. Is there like a third thing you thought of or you're thinking about, which is like a super low level thing you just need, right, in order for the friction to be low enough to do a bunch of these deals? Or do you think those are the two key bits?
There's a couple other parts. So one of them I think of as reducing the friction of doing due diligence by making it so that you like have the information available and you trust that information is real. And so thinking about like, why do public companies in the US, they're able to raise debt far easier than smaller companies, even in the US, and it's because like they're required by the SEC to make all their financials public. And so that reduces the frictions for folks who are evaluating them to do due diligence on them. And so there's that aspect of like what we need in crypto too, with the way some of the exchanges are trying to do ZK proofs of like their holdings and like how can we use crypto to reduce that friction, like really create trust and share that information in a way that people know is accurate and they can evaluate and reduces the frictions there of doing the due diligence. I think that's another big part of it.
Yeah, I think that's a really fascinating one. That's like kind of the balance sheet due diligence.
Yeah.
And like, do you have the assets you say you have is like an interesting one.
Obviously, the more you can provably disclose, the better rates you'll get.
But I think that's almost like an optimization versus is there anything super fundamental you have to be able to prove?
I view it at some level beyond optimization, I think, because when we talk to a lot of the companies and like why they are able or not able to raise capital, just that whole like getting all of the information from this company that's in another country that's far away from you and like knowing for sure that information is accurate. Like a lot of these companies don't always have audited financials because that's expensive. And so it is an optimization, but it's also sometimes like the blocker, like the friction that's preventing other folks who are willing to spend the time to evaluate whether a potential borrower is good. Just like, is that information actually something that they can use?
Is there any other thing you guys have been thinking about or you've seen that you think is interesting that uses some other form of social or like identity-based collateralization? Like, for instance, like, did this cash flow come in or not come in? Did you sign a bunch of deals I don't know about?
Yeah.
It's just a really hard thing to ever enforce. And that's part of the reason why I think people love the pure virtual world, is like when you have a self-contained system, a lot of these problems become easier. The second you hit clutch space, there's always the like the membrane beyond which you don't see, which can basically make a business extremely valuable or not, or make a cash flow real or not.
The other way to solve this is like the peer-to-peer version where you like basically you're like, look, I can't know, but if every founder pledges their life to me, you know what I mean? Like is there some peer-to-peer strategy that can get you more leverage?
There might be. That's interesting. When I thought about it in like a different direction. So yeah, I think there might be some P2P kind of approach here.
I've seen things people talk at least.
Yeah.
Like real, like staking assets in a certain way.
Right. Yeah. We thought about that too. Is there a staking mechanism? The thing that we found hard to figure out a way forward with was that like, if you are staking an amount of financial value that is less than whatever financial value the entity receives, then there's always this way to game the system. But then if you require people to stake more, basically over-collateralizing it with staking, then you're limited in what you can do. When I think of ways to like reduce the friction, I think of this other path, which will take a while, but getting more of this actual economic activity more natively on chain. And so like an example there would be, okay, you take a business and they make loans to customers, or they just have a bunch of customers, if they could get their customers to pay them directly on chain. And so you see all of their revenue coming directly on chain into their effectively like bank account, which is a smart contract. You could lend against that smart contract, knowing that they have these actual contractual relationships with these customers and seeing the revenue coming in and seeing that those customers, like how much money they have and like their smart contracts. And then you can make a loan to them and it could be enforced on chain where the revenue coming from their customers needs to go towards that loan before it goes back to the customers, basically like that borrower's balance sheet, which is effectively a smart contract, which is like this other world of how do we get more actual economic activity happening through smart contracts instead. That's where my mind usually goes of, okay, how do we like really get to this place where you can have a lot more like assurance on chain of what you're lending against, and like you know for sure that you're being collateralized by those cash flows.
If you can figure out a way that beyond just the like, is this a real business check, there's either like some bounty system, or if everyone in your local community is invested, I think you're probably not going to steal from all your neighbors because they'll kill you.
If I'm going to lend halfway around the world, it's like you have two lenders. One's like, I have this amazing looking business, but I have absolutely no idea if it's real. The other's like, I have this business and literally everyone in my local community has something at stake in me winning or losing. And like, they're going to be so pissed if I'm cheating. Like, there's a way to think about that.
I think businesses have built on that a bit too, like with microfinance too, in lending circles has a similar kind of a concept there, and it has provenly worked. And so, yeah, I think for sure that could work. Yeah.
Is there a way that you could pool different types of businesses within a particular community and use that as the underwriting logic for them? I don't know if this exists in emerging markets, but at least in the EU, you have things like the open banking API where it's like, hey, provide read access to all of your cash flow statements and you can lower your cost of capital or increase accessibility to X. Are there other sources of off-chain data or oracles aside from identity that could prospectively be used in aggregate to underwrite this particular set of businesses within this category within this country?
Yeah. All financial statement kind of information. If that were proven on chain in some form, and or if it were even just like, oh, the auditor becomes an oracle that is auditing and making sure the financials listed on chain are accurate, like, yeah, that can have a big impact. You have a lot more information and you know for sure that is correct and you can build on it. And then the really cool stuff gets into when you can also start building smart contract logic on top of that information. So for example, a lot of these loans will have covenants and it, like you are missing certain kind of like ratios in your financials, then you can't borrow anymore, for example. And if that could be enforced directly on chain, then like that also reduces the friction and increases trust for folks providing capital, knowing that like all of these terms are going to be like truly enforced, and you almost don't even need legal systems for those specific kinds of covenants to be enforced because the smart contract is doing it.
I will say again, I'm coming off as a skeptic. I'm not a skeptic. I just spent a lot of time and effort believe that this is the path forward for crypto and an incredibly valuable thing for the world,
which is to figure out how to lower the cost, basically the friction cost of capitalism, to the point that like you can support a vast majority more businesses with expanded liquidity and therefore value.
But like, covenants is an interesting one. I think the version 1.0 of covenants is, okay, you have a bunch of covenants and if blah, blah gets blown, then blah, blah happens. And you write that in a contract and you're done. In real capitalism, that's not actually how it works, right? And what happens is if you're the private equity shop or something, you blow a bunch of covenants. That's just the point where everyone goes and like renegotiates everything. Like it's used as leverage. It's not actually a thing you want to necessarily pull the trigger on. Same with bankruptcy. And I've learned this firsthand recently with some of this stuff, right? Which is like in your head, you're like, oh, a thing goes bankrupt.
Yeah.
And then you're done, right? And like you want that as code. Whereas what really happens is like a thing goes bankrupt or is it should be going bankrupt. And there's a question of who pushes it into bankruptcy, whether it's worth pushing it into bankruptcy. And then everyone negotiates with each other to find like the best outcome. Like I'm a big believer in lower friction, simplify, use crypto. Frankly, even just having a global language for contracting is a huge deal because the cost of lawyers is absurd and like it stops a lot of business. So I think there's a big opportunity.
But I also do just wonder, when you go down the chain on this and get more and more sophisticated, how you think about the chain of actual actions, right? And whether you actually want things like automatic sweeps, et cetera, you know what I mean? Like when you blow confidence, or whether there's something else that has to happen when you start matching up the digital world and the physical world.
There will always be, like you said, you need to, usually when a company's getting into this place of starting to miss covenants or having issues, then you get into a negotiation stage and you figure out, okay, like, oh, you're going to have trouble like paying back in 6 months. Well, what if you slowly pay it back in 12 months and start paying it back early or something like that? And like working with borrowers or something like that to make it work better for them. And I think that'll always exist. It's hard to have, like you said, like exact equations and formulas that just do everything automatically. And one example I think is pretty common to give a credit line to someone is that you can borrow up to $10 million, but you're going to start with $1 million now and then $1 million in a few months, $1 million after that. But the whole time you have to be maintaining the right like debt ratios. And so if you break that ratio, then you can't just get that next $1 million out, which is a valuable thing to be able to do and to be able to enforce. But that's like an example of like a small, like optimized covenant.
We did have an example of this though recently with the FTX collapse, and that they had two versions of creditors, right? They had the off-chain creditors, the lending desks, et cetera, and then they had the on-chain creditors, the lending pools on Solana, Ethereum. And
yeah,
what was interesting, the off-chain stuff all got pushed into bankruptcy, but when shit really hit the fan, they couldn't go to the smart contract and say, hey, no, I'm good for it. They actually had to pay it back. Otherwise, that money would have been liquidated and swept. And so it is a good forcing function to make people come correct.
Similar to this live conversation, this may be part of it, but you've started in emerging markets where there's such constraint on local capital, where people may be willing to overlook some of the risks of crypto. What do you think will move the needle in markets like the US, where there is local capital available?
We began in emerging markets, and a lot of that was because the borrowers have such an unmet need that they were willing to like jump through hoops to use the system. Like I remember talking to the first company, they were based in Nigeria, and we were like, you have to use a MetaMask Chrome plugin to get your capital. Because we would talk to other borrowers who were a little more established, and they're like, there's no way I'm going to use MetaMask. And we're like, you got to use MetaMask. And they're like, no. So we started with the borrowers who like had the biggest unmet need, because they were willing to jump through those hoops and figure it out. And they were like borrowing like $1 million through a MetaMask Chrome plugin, but it was worth it for them. But then over time, what we found is like, there's no shortage of borrowers, even in the US. So like right now, the US represents 20% of the capital that Goldfinch has deployed to borrowers. And more, as more people use crypto, they're more willing to like use these systems. I think that's basically where we're able to keep expanding to markets, including developed countries, is that there are borrowers who need capital everywhere. When you reduce the frictions for them to get the capital they need, like it's great for them.
Is the binary yes-no on access really the crux of it? You know, because a lot of folks talk about the cost of capital for the individuals, putting aside the fact that they can't access it to the degree that they need to in their local markets for whatever reason. Are they actually getting a better deal, or are there exceptions to that rule in terms of the cost of capital?
They're not getting a better deal. All the rates are market rates. For them, it's access and speed. So like for a lot of these businesses, the way they'll raise capital is they'll talk to a bunch of family offices and institutional investors and high net worth individuals, and it'll be 3 months, 6 months, sometimes even longer to get the capital. And it's just like they were talking about how they spend half their time just on raising capital. And so when you provide them with access that makes it easier for them and they can do it faster, they're willing to pay higher rates, frankly. Now, what we have been doing as a general like principle is just matching market rates on Goldfinch, but it's not right now. It's not about lowering the cost of capital. It's just about getting that capital faster so they can be growing their businesses.
Zooming out, a lot of the infrastructure exists today for this to function to a certain point. What in your mind are some of the bigger technical limitations? Whether I know you mentioned things like ZK attestation, scalability, transaction costs, on-ramps, like in this broad spectrum of things over the next year or so, what still needs to fall into place to improve it? Put it to a specific question, is Ethereum sufficient for you to run the operations you need to, or do you need to look at things like a scalability solution for lowering transaction costs for smaller dollar borrowers?
That's a great question. So one of the reasons we started Goldfinch focused on other businesses is because we aren't as concerned about the scaling issues with gas costs, because when we're doing $1 million loans, even paying $100, $200 for a single Ethereum transaction is like not a big deal. And so that was one of the reasons why it made a lot of sense. I also think just generally for a while, it'll be mostly larger loans to businesses because that's just like easier to scale from a non-technical side in terms of having evaluation systems in place. It's like really hard to evaluate customers for a $1,000 loan, for example.
Yeah.
So I think at least for Goldfinch specifically, the scaling issue is something that as a community, we can be procrastinating for a little bit. But as soon as the protocol wants to do more like direct on-chain loans, say to consumers that are like smaller dollar values, Ethereum won't work for that with the transaction costs. And so we'll need some sort of scaling solutions, whether it's an L2 or something else like that, or a different chain. So that's one aspect, at least in terms of technical bottlenecks today. The really big one that keeps coming up for us are the on and off ramps, which I said before. But it's not just like additional countries, which is part of it. Like borrowers in other countries like Mali, like how do they get the capital? But I would also say for institutions, for example, a lot of them really struggle to interact directly with the protocol. Like a lot of institutions have their custody and like practices and they're dealing with lots of money and it's hard for them to just like do $1 million into a protocol using like a MetaMask plugin. Like I don't know how you all handle it like at Slow, for example, but we came into a lot of frictions there with institutions. And so I view this like on off ramp and like, how do you actually interact with these protocols in a way that like meet the needs of these different kinds of folks is like another big technical hurdle we have to get past.
That makes a lot of sense. And then I just big picture.
Yeah.
Yeah. To the future, the RWA ecosystem and the things that you see happening specific to Goldfinch or just around the market more broadly, like what has you most excited or what keeps you optimistic about the next 3 to 5 years?
This is such a big, complex space. We need a lot of different pieces to all come together and keep building on each other. And you get leverage by doing that. And so frankly, I'm just excited about how many folks are working on it right now, including in the down market, where it's like a good time to build and getting all of these different pieces in place. So from like what Goldfinch is doing about taking private credit deals and like bringing them on chain, to infrastructural pieces, doing things like KYC and creating like oracles, to people exploring other types of assets, like tokenizing everything from real estate to, what did you describe, soybean? Yeah, I just think like it really can grow fast when we start having all of these different pieces together and like building out all of the components of the market that marketplace essentially build on each other. And yeah, that's generally what I'm most excited about is the range of both the infrastructure and like the type of assets that like a lot of different teams are working on.
I think that makes sense. I think that's what keeps us excited and engaged. I think the two things that stick with me when we talk about the RWA ecosystem is one, the number of people, even crypto native folks that I talk to that have said, hey, it'd be fantastic if I could build an entire portfolio with just my wallet. I can access a diverse set of assets that are uncorrelated, deal that comes from all different sources, and I don't have to interact with another institution or add up another Fidelity account, even in the US, right?
Yeah.
And then the second piece, and this is stealing from Sam, is the line around Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett aren't going to use on-chain rails until real products and real assets actually exist there that they can't access elsewhere to build that diversified portfolio. And so I think the work that you're doing and folks around the space that are this small but really enthusiastic group of individuals and teams is what's going to make that happen in earnest. And so I think that's what keeps us really excited here.
Hey man, let's force good old Charlie to buy some crypto if he wants to or not.
Yeah.
I look forward to dancing on his grave.
So I think that's a good place to stop. This has been awesome and an awesome first edition of the Slow Burn Pool House, whatever we're going to call it, podcast. And yeah, for the rest of the Slow Crypto team, our awesome guest, Mike.
I'm Clay, and we'll see you next month.
I like the rest of the team. The entire team is in this room.
Yeah, the entire team. Yes. Big organization.